Thank you, Tommy. And thanks to Bill Tracy and Tom for putting this symposium together. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I think it's a timely topic, one that I think by the number of people in the room that I think often gets underlooked as far as its level of importance, and certainly around the world. And for those of you that went to Borlaug's lecture last night, I think really pointed out the disparity between how the world spends resources and invests in resources and how we think about genetic vulnerability. And so anyway, really appreciate the opportunity to address the group. And I also want to say I am not an expert on T cytoplasm in any way, shape, or form. I am going to do a little bit of history on it as best I can from a historical perspective. I was 7 years old on a farm in north central Iowa growing up in 1970, so I wasn't intimately involved with the farm making decisions at the time, but and then Stephen Smith, who I encouraged to participate and accept the invitation to talk at this, originally asked me, well, if I'm going to do it, will you be willing to be a co-author? And then eventually he wiggled his way into me being the speaker at this event, which is fine. I don't speak with the same fine English accent that Stephen does, for those of you that know him, but I'll do my best here to and I'm going to give it a little different perspective, as I've been right smack in the middle of commercial corn breeding since I left North Carolina State in 1991. So, and Stephen's come at things from a little different perspective than myself. So I'll probably put a little different twist on the whole situation than he would have. So the things I'm going to go through this morning, I will give a little bit of a history as I know it and perceive it on T cytoplasm, and then also speak about the U.S. maize genetic diversity past situation, and then some ongoing efforts of how Pioneer thinks about maize genetic diversity and what I think are some of the most likely risks that we face in the corn world. And then just finish up with some recommendations and what some future possibilities might look like. So T cytoplasm, in 1970, in about June of 1970, it started to the southern corn leaf blight started to spread up into the upper Midwest, throughout Iowa, Illinois, certainly Indiana, and was recognized at that time as in fact race T southern leaf blight. And there was probably, by our estimates, probably greater than 80% of the corn crop that summer was in T cytoplasm. Just assuming that probably most of this audience knows, but in case you don't, T cytoplasm was a cytoplasmic male sterility that was used because of the ease of corn production to produce commercial hybrid seed at the time. And so by July of that summer, it was the infections were pretty widespread all the way into the upper Midwest and north all the way to Canada. And very distinct difference, very race-specific disease, clear distinction between sterile and fertile. The fertile of ISO lines were perfectly fine, ISO hybrids were perfectly fine, and the T cytoplasm vert strain was very, very highly susceptible to the disease. And so best estimates, I think, in the summer of 70 was there was about a 20 to 30% average yield loss across the U.S. But certainly in the southeastern part of the U.S., it was a much more dramatic impact to southern corn leaf blight, and probably as much as half or more of the grain loss in the southeastern part of the U.S. that year. Overall, I think Ulstrup in that 1972 oft-quoted publication was a $1 billion estimate to the U.S. corn crop in that summer. So how did the industry react to this? Well, my understanding from some of the people that were high up in Pioneer at the time, this was a high-level crisis situation, one which I think all of the industry recognized could put any one company out of business individually if we didn't make a quick turnover and recover to using some fertile and normal cytoplasms. And so the obvious reaction was to quickly get back to the fertile seed stocks on the female side that was used, and to get back to manually detasseling. And so that's what what everybody did. We regenerated a lot of seed stocks, and those companies that were able to do that rapidly and ramp up those seed stocks were those that benefited the most. And those that had a system and could hire the kids and had production plants in places where kids were accessible, and you could hire farm kids off the farm to come work and detassel it was absolutely critical. And the industry responded pretty well to a near crisis situation. That, I think, probably along with some other things, prompted a National Research Council report in 1972. It talked about the genetic uniformity and the basis of vulnerability to epidemics, and asking the question, really, how uniform genetically are other crops? And the basic response, more or less, was most crops are impressively uniform and impressively, or maybe it's depressively, vulnerable. And understanding that uniformity really does derive from very powerful forces, our society really demands uniformity. It's perceived that consistency and stability of production is in fact derived from uniform varieties. And farmers, certainly above all, have come to expect, at least in agricultural crops, very uniform and consistent production from individual plant to individual plant. And so at the same time, it's recognized, I think, broadly that plant breeding improvements are in fact predictably accompanied by a drop in genetic diversity. And that's no surprise, as you make selections and you throw out the best and keep the worst. So diversity is, in all likelihood, it's inevitable and it's going to be impacted. So substantial challenges faced the nation, according to the National Research Council. We needed to exercise constant vigilance in watching for new hazards in terms of genetic vulnerability, and to understand more about the life history of parasites, I think, and pathogens was also a pretty important piece that they recognized. And certainly a lot of the plant pathology programs were impacted positively in this effort throughout the 70s and 80s. And the general conclusion then, however, that diversity in and of itself didn't bring value, and that in fact exotic germplasm was largely untested and especially at the time in maize, very poorly adapted to temperate conditions. So just a very quick piece on cytoplasmic diversity, some selected examples from other crops. Other crops have used it. Sorghum has largely been based on this A1 cytoplasm, mainly used since the 70s, and really haven't experienced a major problem with it. But they have, as a result of the epidemic in corn, did develop some other cytoplasms, which are generally considered about five other sources. And they've come up with, and I think this is our pioneer probably perspective, that we could in fact recover within 3 years if a problem with A1 occurred. So for a crop like sorghum, in most parts of the world, that's probably a reasonable response. And canola, cytoplasmic systems have been pretty widely used, and apparently there's even more than four completely different systems, and so they feel that the genetic diversity there, at least due to the cytoplasm diversity, is sufficient. Sunflower has had one cytoplasm, a long history with nothing deleterious yet in with sunflowers. However, millet, I think, is one other example, and you can read the detail there, but really it traced back to this source that was introduced from Tifton, Georgia, and fairly significant issue, over 12 million hectares, I believe that was in India, where the hybrids had a major impact from downy mildew epidemics. So going on to what are some of our ongoing efforts towards maize genetic diversity in the industry, and what are some of the most likely risks? So Pioneer's response to cytoplasmic use of cytoplasmic sterility in production systems was extremely slow to react and very conservative in our response, and when we started using cytoplasmic diversity again in commercial production in corn. And And at the same time, there were a lot of investigations done within Pioneer as to what were the alternative sources. People looked at C cytoplasm, S cytoplasm, as well as different types within each one. There was a lot of molecular characterization that was done within Pioneer through the 80s and I guess probably into the early 90s, but certainly through the 80s. I know when Arthur Weisinger was still at Pioneer before he went to North Carolina State, I know Arthur, together with Mark Albertson, had been very active in characterizing these different cytoplasmic types. But I will also tell you that the high levels of decision-making at Pioneer were very conservative and cautious to walk down the road of using male sterility again. And we have, since that time, done that and are using cytoplasmic diversity effectively today and using the CNS types. However, it's also interesting to note, and I'll comment here, that with the advent of GMO traits and the incentive to get GMO traits to the market quickly, I think a lot of companies have kind of pushed aside the incentive and the value from a cost production standpoint of producing seed, that sterile cytoplasm, yeah, it's important, but we're also looking for other systems. And that kind of brings you to the 2000, where people have thought about transgenic pollen control systems to use effectively, but at the very least, numerous fertile cytoplasmic types can be used under those kinds of systems, and that's been an insistence, at least for our company. So what about the nuclear genome? I want to talk a little bit about this, and certainly there have been a whole series of maize genetic diversity studies that have been done in maize from 1956 through today. There was the series of the ASTA surveys, and you can see the years there. There was the Darren Zuber, often quoted 1986 crop science paper on basically the maize diversity survey. And then even at Pioneer, Stephen Smith and others, Howie Smith and others were involved in leveraging the various stages and evolution of marker data from isozymes and Zeons on through RFLPs, and of course presently we've moved from SSRs and years ago to SNPs, and so we've gone through the whole evolution of how do we use markers and look at a molecular level. But really, you know, there has been no official broad U.S. based survey done on genetic diversity since that last paper that Pioneer put into the literature in 1991, and Stephen Smith, I think, was probably the senior author on that paper. There's been no published marker data really since that 1989 season where we surveyed a group of hybrids throughout the industry. There has been a pedigree evaluation in the Michael and Dudley paper from 2006, and then Stephen has a 2007 paper that kind of expanded beyond that pedigree data a bit. So, but the point here is there's been no publicly driven survey to evaluate maize hybrids in the marketplace. So I said before that, you know, we've known that, and it's expected that genetic diversity goes down over time. And so this is just a selected sample based on molecular marker data of a set of Pioneer inbreds, and really demonstrating that over many generations of breeding selection, major allele frequency increases. Those are the red lines, and the black lines are that gene diversity actually decreases. And over time, that is in fact the expected outcome of successful breeding programs. So we always ask, how is it that we can antagonize this ever narrowing genetic diversity fight that we're up against? And so we can look at a lot more dense maps today. This is, of course, chromosomes 1 through 10 going from top to bottom across a set of Pioneer inbreds, representing a set of commercial hybrids in a limited maturity band. That's about as much detail as I give you without having to, you know, make you sign confidentiality releases. But the point is here, we can do now a very dense molecular map and really get at the diversity on a molecular scale, chromosome by chromosome, and really look for those areas where we are quite uniform. And in this set of germplasm in a limited maturity band, we can begin to see parts of the chromosome, and I'll just point to the top of chromosome 7 here, and you can see a large section that is all blue all the way across. And incidentally, the split down the middle here is females to males. So the colors trace back to a set of founder lines that we consider the base across multiple cycles of breeding. And then the inbreds to the right are the non-stiff stocks traditionally used as males. And so we can start to pinpoint parts of the chromosomes that are either on the female side or the male side that are really getting narrow and quite uniform, and start to ask the question, okay, outside of this commercial set of inbreds, where do I need to go to think about some genetic diversity expansion? And then you can begin to overlay this over the top of QTL maps and marker trait association maps and begin to understand where might we have an issue of vulnerability by trait. So as a lead in to Jim's talk coming up here, talking on anthracnose, we need to begin to overlay what's the trait variation that we're experiencing in breeding populations? And if our target or goal in the marketplace is to achieve, let's say, a 5 or a 6 for anthracnose resistance, and that's positive on our scale, 9 is best and 1 is worst, what's the distribution look like in breeding populations, real life breeding populations that breeders are working with? And if, in fact, our commercial products need to be out here on the tail, what do we need to do to, if we're making crosses down on this end between these guys, what do we need to do to select for to get out here on the other end of the tail? And how does that relate to that previous diversity map that we can look at? Okay, so shifting directions here just a bit. I want to go to my notes on this one to get this right, but this was provided to Stephen courtesy of Dr. Kitty Cardwell with the USDA CSRERS. And the mission here is the National Plant Disease Network, developed by Secretary of Ag, to develop a network linking plant and animal disease and diagnostic facilities around the country. And I think this has been a successful endeavor across crops and across species to try to monitor at a public level what the areas of vulnerability might be. And then to continue to foster that, and Pioneer has been encouraging and supportive of this effort, but we also have our diagnostic disease labs that are scattered around the country for us at our outlying centers, and then of course localized at headquarters in Johnston, where we're as best as we can engaging in this public-private collaborative effort on in the crops that we do business in. So I think that's been an important effort. A little bit more on maize diversity here is that there have been more recent studies in as remote a places as Cuba and Albania to do some diversity studies on maize, and I think this is where Stephen really wanted to point out that when you get to places like Cuba and Albania, how much more important is it to be doing a maize genetic diversity study within the U.S. And so this has been Stephen's card all along to try to encourage the public to get engaged in this maize diversity study. The other thing that I would like to point out in a couple slides here is that we're in a situation where arable land is certainly not going to increase, and if you look over just the last decade, crop area, that lower right corner there, has only increased on a global scale by 4%. But when you look at the demand on corn consumption over that same period of time, increasing at 32%, and also soybeans increasing at 59%, and meat consumption going up at 25%, it's just imperative that we ensure a stable predictable amount of crop production. And so when you look at global corn product production and consumption over time since 1991, you can just see that dramatic increase. And there's just in today's rate of corn consumption, there's just little room for error. And the volume of product and the demand on that volume is so critical each year that there's not much room for error. Okay. So what are the greatest risks to stability of global maize production? We've said that it's increasing. The highest risk is a significant reduction in quantity. And I would say it's probably due to diseases or a widespread drought. And it is impressive to think of even some of the drought areas that we've had that modern day hybrids are certainly more stable and more drought resistant than hybrids from 10, 20 years ago. But diseases, I think, is still a major risk for us. And I think it's more likely nuclear rather than cytoplasmic diseases that would be the issue, quite frankly. And the greatest risk, I think, is really in a very few individual inbreds that are used commercially in high volume. And when you think about the relatively low and, in fact, decreasing number of true genetic suppliers to maize and crops as important as maize and soybeans, and ask the question, is there a connection between, a relationship between the number of genetic developers and tendency towards narrowness or genetic vulnerability. So just a few comments on recommendations and future possibilities. Again, this is another pitch here that I see some of the USDA folks sitting in the room that might be able to help influence this, but no molecular-based surveys published since 1989, field season. Bag tag, no research restrictions, really makes it complex for public researchers. We have to have private sector motivation and agreement to be able to conduct such a survey, or it makes it really difficult for a public lab to get this done. So I think future molecular-based diversity survey really is appropriate role for the public and for an academic or USDA lab to conduct. And I would also comment here that one of the possible contributing factors to a decrease in genetic diversity is, in fact, the restructuring and the realignment in the seed industry, the acquisitions, the mergers that have occurred, and the imperative or the resulting decrease in the number of true genetic developers that are going to be in the industry, particularly in maize and soybeans in coming years. I think with that, I'm gonna go on to this slide. So our proposal is that there be a future and periodic maize genetic diversity study done, probably at least on a decade-by-decade basis. It must be assayed directly via sampling from commercial hybrids that are truly grown on the farm, and it should be conducted by a public lab, and it really, in fact, will require the cooperation and acceptance of the majority of the seed companies in order for this to occur. And I don't underestimate the level of a challenge that will be to convince everybody that this is an important study that needs to be done. We need to continue leveraging technologies for evaluating and expanding diversity, certainly molecular markers, doubled haploids, and multiple generations per year, and get back to sound management and stewardship of genetic resources. Really, all the tools that we have today allow us to evaluate and understand and appreciate better where we're at and what the true level of genetic and vulnerability and risk is. And we're going to continue as a company, as Pioneer, to encourage efforts like LAMP and germplasm enhancement of maize, which I think give an opportunity for the training of students as well as for a broader appreciation for the risks that the world faces, because this is a global issue regarding genetic stability and stability of crop production. So I'm gonna, one quick comment here is I think we've made some good headway towards visibility to customers and growers about variety ID and brands, and we're very supportive of the system of making this transparent, so you can get, when you buy a bag of seed, you see the variety ID, you know what's on the bag, and you know what you're buying, and you know what it's related to. So that's my last slide, and I'll close with that.
Thank you, Dave. Great.
Okay.